All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today is a Monday mailbag episode where I will be answering your listener questions dealing with all things Falcons.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman. I've been covering the Falcons for many years at FalFans.com, on Twitter at FalFans, and of course, I'm the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today, I am answering your listener questions, another Q&A episode, a Monday mailbag, sort of a common theme that we do throughout the offseason. Most of these questions were submitted via Twitter and Facebook, and of course, the two places to submit those questions, if you're on the social medias, is of course Locked On Falcons on both Twitter and Facebook. That's the place to be. But you can also, of course, submit your questions via email at lockedonfalcons@mail.com, or you can leave a comment at falcons.com where the podcast is posted daily. So without any further ado, let's jump right into it. Our first question comes from Zamir Sabanovich at Zamir406 on Twitter. Considering the news that something is going on with Jack McKinley's mental health, if it's actually true, is that quote-unquote fact putting more pressure on the Falcons to find somebody in free agency and or the draft, someone or both? Zamir submitted this question earlier in the week before we got an update on Tack in terms of him doing fine. But no, I don't think Tack McKinley's, whatever his issues, if he's having any, put any pressure on the Falcons. I don't think the Falcons need to be, or at least let me say this. I'm not worried about Tack McKinley. So to me, the issue is, 2019 in my eyes was always going to be Tack's make or break year. So, assuming that he, plays this season, which I have every reason to believe that he will, we'll see what he does. And then the Falcons can make a decision about his future and maybe look in a direction of potentially replacing or upgrading him or whatever the case may be, or doing nothing based off of what happens this season. So nothing, so far nothing that has occurred this offseason would sort of accelerate that timeline for me. Next question comes from Rise Up Till I'm Toes Up at Padre0920 on Twitter. What do you feel is the main reason why Marquand Manuel got fired? Basically results. I think the struggles of the defense, particularly during that 5-game losing streak, sort of was what doomed him. The defense did not play well during that time. I know we sort of blame the offense for why the team lost, because the offense also struggled during that time. But certainly the defense did not play at all well during that stretch of time, particularly when you look at their sort of drive stats. I think they had given up like the second highest percentage of drives that resulted in scores, with like 51% during that 5-game streak, which is extremely high for those of you that don't know. I think that was like second worst in the league. Next question comes from Vienna Falcons. He asks, is there anyone on the coaching staff that you'd like to see take the game management role now with Kyle Flood's departure? Not really. I don't really care. Luke Harrison's question at Luke O Harrison 12. What's the cornerback situation going to look like? Is Alford still going to be here? If not, is Oliver ready to step up? It doesn't seem like Alford's going to stick around. Is Oliver ready? We'll find out this season. Personally, I think the Falcons need to sort of sign a veteran cornerback to be insurance policy. And that's part of the reason why I'm not as gung ho as everybody else is to get rid of Robert Alford. Because I think you're going to have to find somebody in there that's going to be at least a competent NFL caliber starter that you can sort of plug and play with in the event that Oliver is not ready. And I think going with a rookie, drafting another rookie, whether that's a first round pick or a third round pick or wherever, doesn't help you, because again, you got guys like Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs and Michael Thomas and Mike Evans and T.Y. Hilton and DeAndre Hopkins on the schedule, and throwing a rookie and arguably even Isaiah Oliver to the wolves like that, and thinking, oh yeah, this guy's going to give us high level play, I think is a gamble. With Oliver, at least you can make an argument that you're willing to make that gamble, because Oliver is a very talented player. But just, having Oliver and another rookie sort of being sort of, in the event that they're not good, which is possible, it's not guaranteed that they're going to be superstars, you're going to have some very questionable cornerback play. But so we'll see if the Falcons do wind up going after a veteran cornerback, or do they draft a cornerback. But it does seem very likely that Robert Alford, at the very least, is gone. Luke Harrison's next question is Allen or Casey? If you're asking me who should be the starting free safety, it's Allen. That's an easy answer. My God is an angry metal bird god at bird god cultist on Twitter. A lot of speculation about the replacing Reed slash Beasley, the left guard slash right tackle, and drafting another starting caliber D tackle. I'm not opposed to any of these moves, but can they really get that many starters like linebacker in 2015? Having the cap space doesn't always get you the free agent you want. I don't think replacing Reed slash Beasley or adding another starting caliber defensive tackle is going to be a huge obstacle for the team. I do think adding three starters on the offensive line is probably not realistic. I'd be a lot more skeptical about that. It's not impossible, but it's a little hard to do. Especially, well, let's say you can sign three people or draft three people to be starters. Whether you hit on all three of those guys is, where the skepticism comes in. I think largely that's due to the fact that the draft is very unreliable when it comes to adding day one starters. We've seen that with guys like Jalen Collins and Tevin Coleman and Austin Hooper and Isaiah Oliver, etc. And this year's free agent crop is particularly thin across the offensive line. So if I was guessing right now, I think my suspicion right now, again, this is a guess, but my suspicion is that the Falcons will try to add a starter at left guard and then have Fusco and or Schweitzer compete for the right guard spot and then add a potential another starter at right tackle. So I think adding two starters is at least a little bit more palatable, or at least a little bit, I'm a little less skeptical of that. But I do think if they're going to pull off that off, I think waiting until the draft to add those two starters doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So you probably need to be a little bit proactive and try to get one of those guys in free agency at the very least. So we got a lot more questions to answer on today's episode. But before we do, you guys probably heard about, some conference championship games. And you definitely want to check out the Locked On NFL podcast with host Matt Williamson, because today, as you're probably listening to this episode, might as well go ahead and subscribe to that podcast so you can get Matt's thoughts on that game as well as future games. It's one very big game coming up, so maybe you want to check out the Locked On NFL podcast wherever you get your Locked On podcast, your team every day. All right, RG at RG Integer on Twitter. We all know Thomas Dimitroff likes to trade up to get their guy, but what are the chances of trading back in the first to gain draft capital in later rounds in an attempt to fix the quality of our depth? This is a decent chance. It's January. Everything's on the table at this point in time, this offseason, guys. So, yeah, man, there's a chance that happens. I, again, sitting here trying to elaborate on sort of what they could or could not do at this point in the offseason, I think it's just kind of just, a Hail Mary at this point. Let's wait until, let's see what they do. Like, again, so much of what they're going to do in the draft is going to be dependent on what they do in free agency. So speculating about what they could or could not do in the draft is basically, you can literally say anything right now about what the Falcons draft plans could be. They could take a quarterback, probably not in the first round, but certainly in the fifth round, that's on the table because it depends on what they do with their backup quarterback situation in free agency. Do they re-sign Matt Schaub? Do they go out and get another veteran? Maybe they go with Kurt Banker. I have no idea. Again, everything's on the table right now. So as far as trading back, yeah, it's a possibility. We'll see. My God is an angry bird god at Bird God Cultist on Twitter. Your DB to win theory was pretty good, but what about the Falcoholic sacrifices to our shiny metal god? Looks like it halted the losing streak. Is Todd Monken here in 2020 after Quinn is thrown to the fiery pit to atone for Dirk's red zone issues mentioned on Friday's podcast? I'm not familiar with the DB to win theory that you're supposedly, I don't recall what that is. So I apologize if I don't get the joke there. As for what happened in 2020, we'll see what happens in 2019. Just a thought experiment, not suggesting that the Falcons are going to fire their head coach or anything like that. Just thinking about things, because we're, it's January. We can be a little bit more free with the hypotheticals at this point in time. But looking ahead to 2020, I will be curious, in the event that Dan Quinn is no longer the head coach of the Falcons, I will be curious to see sort of what direction Arthur Blank goes. You would typically, you know, most teams in the Falcons have, for the most part, followed this, although you can maybe say, no, maybe not. I don't know. Since Arthur Blank has hired three straight defensive, or no, I forgot about Petrino. Three out of four of his hires have been defensive coaches. So I think my guess would be that he would probably go with an offensive mind just because, you know, that's the sort of in vogue thing to do. So it would be interesting to sort of see if that is something he would try to do on the next hire, whenever that is, 2020 or 2027, who knows at this point. But just something to think about. Glaze at Everett underscore G07. What are the three best wing flavors of all time? Ooh, that's a tough question. I could do a whole podcast. I'd probably do a whole series of podcasts on that. Let's just say the three that are in my go-to rotation are lemon pepper, honey garlic pepper, and honey sriracha. I, you know, as quickly on all three of those, I was not a huge fan of lemon pepper until maybe like a year or two ago. Cause like, I don't, you know, I'm not from Atlanta, full disclosure. I have not had the experience of eating, you know, hometown Atlanta lemon pepper wings, but, outside the state of, or outside the city of Atlanta, lemon pepper wings are trash because for most of my life I lived with this belief that like when people would say, oh, I love lemon pepper wings, I'm like, why? They're just okay. And it's kind of funny because most of the wings until I basically watched a YouTube video to learn how to make real Atlanta lemon pepper wings, which probably is not that authentic. That was like the first time, and that was like 2 years ago. It was like, that was the first time I had lemon pepper wings. Like, oh, I get it. Like, and not to suggest that like those were like the real thing, but it was just like, oh, now I understand why people like lemon pepper. So it, in the last 2 years, it's sort of become a regular part of my rotation. But before that, I was just kind of like, yeah, they're okay. Like, they're not all that. There's this local wing place that makes honey garlic pepper. That's their best flavor. I've actually had their lemon peppers and they're trash. Their best flavor is honey garlic pepper. And I've started sort of to make that into, as a part of my regular rotation. And that's as simple as it sounds, is honey, garlic, and pepper. And then honey sriracha. I like spicy wings. I don't know if you guys know about this nice little fun little YouTube show called Hot Ones. And I started watching that show like maybe like 3 years ago. And they eat scorching hot chicken wings, and it's an interview show, and it has a variety of celebrities and rappers and various other people that I've never heard of until they jump on that show. And ever since then, like, I've been preferring spicier wings. I don't go to the ridiculous levels of spice, if you guys are familiar with the show Hot Ones, but I do like a little heat, but I do like when you can't just have heat for the sake of heat. You got to have a little flavor with it. So I like to cut my heat with a little bit of sweetness and, you know, honey, obviously. And then sriracha is a very tasty hot sauce, in my opinion. So that adds a little bit of flavor to the heat. You know, I add more heat than what is naturally in sriracha, but that's the main sort of flavor component. I usually add a lot of cayenne pepper, and I got this little habanero extract that I made it like a year or two ago when I was making my own fermented hot sauce. There you go. Again, I could go deeper, but those are the main three ones that are in my rotation. The next question comes from Tracy Edwards at Vic Tracy Ed on Twitter. Do you feel Ricky Ortiz will still be valuable in Cutter's offense, or will there be another fullback search this offseason? I don't know. I think Ricky Ortiz is basically under contract, so there's no reason to change unless they're basically like, we want a better fullback than Ricky Ortiz, which, look, I like Ricky Ortiz. I think he did a pretty solid job considering it was sort of his first year. He was a rookie. He had some good moments. He had some not so good moments. I think he's a guy that you can sort of develop over the next couple of years. I think he's talented enough to be a solid NFL fullback. I don't see why you would punt on him, but if you are going to be a team that the Falcons for some reason want to be, but then don't invest in the position, but if you're going to use the fullback as much as the Falcons do, then it does make sense to spend a little bit of money on it, you know? And a guy by the name of Jay Prosh is out there. He's a very solid fullback that got cut by the Texans because the Texans, once they added Deshaun Watson, basically eliminated the fullback from their offense and became a two tight end offense. And that's interesting because Dirk Koetter, primarily in Tampa Bay, they were a two tight end offense. They did dabble with the fullback, Alan Cross, and some other guys, Dan Vitale, over the last couple of years. And, you know, in Jacksonville, they were primarily a two tight end offense, although they did have a pretty solid fullback by the name of Greg Jones there as well. That wasn't really the case in Atlanta because they did have a fullback. That was, you know, the beginnings of Patrick DeMarco's excellent run. We'll see. You know, there's talk of maybe the Bills will move on from Patrick DeMarco this offseason. I don't want to get my hopes up. You know, I can't be that positive and hopeful and optimistic, but we'll see how that happens. But if the Falcons do want to put, long story short, I think if the Falcons do want to upgrade their fullback position, they should have opportunity to do so. We'll see sort of if they sort of instead be like, oh, we'll keep Ortiz, or we will finally, you know, dial back the fullback's usage as the Falcons weird. It's so weird, man. If you guys don't know what I'm talking about, like I talked about sort of the weird identity that the Falcons don't have because they use a fullback more than most teams in the league, but then they deactivated their fullback during that 5-game streak for like 3 out of those 5 games for no real reason other than reasons, and it just doesn't make any sense because this team doesn't have an identity, and that's part of the problem and why the offense probably is underachieving. Not the only reason, but it's a contributing factor in my humble opinion. But that's a conversation for another day, and if you want to hear more detail of that, go back to the podcast I did about a month or two ago about the Falcons' identity crisis. I think that was in early December, so go check that out. There's more to come. More questions to answer on this podcast, but it is that time of year where NBA season is getting into high gear. Trade deadline's only a couple of weeks away, and if you want to get the latest on what's going on the NBA side of the Locked On Podcast Network, there are 30 daily podcasts devoted to all 30 NBA teams, including the Locked On Hawks podcast with host Brad Rowland. Find that wherever you get your Locked On podcasts, your team every day. All right, Tracy Edwards at Vic Tracy Ed on Twitter's next question is, will you make your pilgrimage to the Mercedes-Benz Stadium next year or continue to deny us your long-awaited appraisal of Arthur Blank's legendary real estate development for sports entertainment? I thought this year was going to be the year, but the Falcons stinking and then sort of money being a little bit tight, sort of just kind of like, So we'll see. I won't make any promises. We'll see what the schedule looks like this year when it drops in April. But I'm hoping that I will be able to make it out this year as opposed to last year. I can't keep punting year after year. Hopefully the Falcons will not be terrible to make me, like, basically I'm a frugal guy, so when the Falcons aren't good, it makes me less enthusiastic to drop, you know, $85 to $100+ on tickets to watch a team that I'm just like, eh. You know, I know that other people are different. I'm not suggesting that my attitude on it is the right attitude, but it's just one of those things where, you know, the travel, the hotel, and the tickets and all that type of stuff seems just to be a hassle to watch a 7-9 team. You know what I'm saying? So hopefully they will, you know, not let me down this year and make me a little bit more enthusiastic about making the pilgrimage to the Mecca of sports entertainment, at least in the city of Atlanta. All right. Next question is from Zamir Sabanovich. He asked this one on Facebook. After today's podcast, it seems that you have changed your stance a little bit about Koetter and about Gerald McCoy possibility being cut. Can you dig into that a bit deeper? He's referring to Friday's episode, I guess it was, when we had Scott Reynolds, the editor, publisher of Pewter Report on. He talked a lot about Dirk Koetter and also talked about sort of Gerald McCoy's potentially having played his last game in Tampa Bay. As for Zamir's question, I don't know how much deeper you need me to go. I mean, for me, it's kind of a wait and see for both situations. We'll see what Koetter brings to the table in September. So endlessly speculating about how good his offense is going to be in the offseason or how bad it's going to be in the offseason, for me at least, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's always fascinating to me, though, that sort of, you know, after 2016, it was all about, you know, when Sark came in, it was all about how great his offense was going to be. And now it's sort of flipped a little bit with Cutter, with a lot more skepticism, which is, I get it, certainly, because I wasn't a big fan of Cutter's offense when he was here in Atlanta. From what I've seen of his offense in Tampa Bay, and again, I haven't studied it extensively, but I've watched a couple of games, including at least a half of the game he called against the Redskins last year. Yeah, it's not as bad as I probably made it out to be initially. I was just sort of revisiting 2013 and 2014. It was sort of fresh in my mind. You know, as for McCoy, we'll see. Again, that's a probably the conversation we'll have to have in March to see if he gets cut. But, you know, going back to Cutter, I think my good friend Charles McDonald says, and I basically agree with him, is that this offense has the talent and basically runs itself. I kind of agree with him. I mean, you just sort of look at last year's offense with Sark, and you sort of take away five quote-unquote unlucky turnovers that they had last year, two against Green Bay, where Sanu, you know, messed up the snap, and then Matt Ryan threw the ball backwards, and they had to settle for a long field goal that was the only miss of Matt Bryant's season that year. And then you take the three red zone fumbles that they had against the Saints, and you take those five drives and turn them into, say, I don't know, 24 points instead of 0 points that the Falcons got on those drives. And all of a sudden, the Falcons offense goes from being the 10th ranked offense, which it was last year, and is the 4th ranked offense in the league, jumping slightly ahead of, I think, the Patriots, because I think they were 22 points behind the Patriots. So, you know, and if that's the case, then I doubt the Falcons fire Steve Sarkisian. So, for me at least, like, is it realistic to think Cutter can get that team to be the 4th best offense in the league? Sure. I guess for me, and this is part of the situation due to the circumstances that, you know, stem from that 2016 season, is I don't know if scoring 436 points or whatever it would have been is good enough. And, you know, that's like the second most in team history, if I'm not mistaken. But I think the expectation, like, you look at the Colts offense. Colts, I think, scored 433 points this year, and they were like 5th or 6th in the league in scoring. But, like, you know, they have T.Y. Hilton and Chester Rogers and Marlon Mack and Eric Ebron, and we have Julio Jones and the great Mohamed Sanu and Calvin Ridley and Austin Hooper and Devontae Freeman and all these sort of things. And it's like, we can't outscore the Colts? Like, I think there's something wrong with that. Like, so to me, like, 430 points is like, that's an accomplishment, but it's not that big a deal. Like, so, yeah, Cutter should be able to do that. I think any competent offensive coordinator should be able to do that. 400, 410, 420 points, 430 points. Any competent offensive coordinator with a healthy Matt Ryan, with a healthy Julio Jones, I won't say he should be able to do that in his sleep, because, you know, the NFL is not that easy, but it is one of those things where you don't need to be a uniquely gifted offensive coordinator to be able to put out that output. But, you know, getting 450, 480 points, you know, where 480 points or higher, now you're starting getting the historic levels where you're considered one of the 20 or 25 best offenses of all time. In my humble opinion, a good offensive coordinator should be able to do that. Whether Cutter's able to do that, and is it fair to expect that to him to do that right out the gate? Maybe not, but, like, that's sort of what my expectations are. So we'll see if Cutter can reach that. So I'm a little bit more optimistic that Cutter will produce a good offense. I probably shouldn't have been pessimistic that he couldn't produce a good offense for the reasons I've outlined. But, you know, in terms of him being a little bit more historical, I'm a little bit more optimistic than I was. But again, I'm not necessarily going to hold my breath with that. But we'll see. Next question comes from Aaron Burke Lumley. And I believe this is the last question. Yes, it is. Another Facebook question. He asks, do you think it's even worth trying to keep Beasley, even if he resigns to a lower contract, or would it be better to try and replace him in free agency or the draft? I can't imagine being too hard to replace a 5-sack-a-year guy, especially since Quinn doesn't seem interested in moving him to linebacker / pass rusher hybrid role. No, I don't think it's worth keeping Beasley. You know, to me, basically, without spending an entire episode talking about Vic Beasley, which is probably coming in the next couple of weeks when we do our roster review. To me, at this point in time, Vic Beasley should be like a third edge, which is the same role that Tack had as a rookie, which is the role that Irvin had for the last second half of the season this year and what Freeney had in 2016. We paid Dwight Freeney $2 million for that role. Obviously, Tack was on a rookie contract, and Bruce Irvin was making $1.5 million over those eight games, so that's about worth $3 million. And does it make sense, then, that if those guys made that type of money, we would pay Vic Beasley like $13 million to play basically the same role? Where, no, it doesn't. And when you actually look at, you know, say, Pro Football Focus pass rushing productivity metrics, both Freeney in 2016 and Irvin in this eight-game run this past season, were far more productive than in those limited roles than what Beasley has been at any point in the last 3 years. And I want to say Tack was also, too, as a rookie. So, you know, you look at some of these numbers, and I'll throw out a couple that I thought were interesting just to shed more light on sort of the mediocrity of sort of Vic Beasley as a pass rusher. Vic Beasley has, in the past two seasons, has 60 combined pressures, 33 this year and 27 in 2017. If you look at that and say, okay, that's about 30 pressures a year, there were 57 edge rushers this past season that had 30 pressures this year. 57. That's almost two per team. So the point being that those guys aren't special. Getting 30 is not special. Getting significantly more than 30 is a little bit special. Now, Vic Beasley rushed the quarterback something like 420 times this year or something like that. So just looking at the edge rushers that rushed the quarterback at least 400 times, there were 33 of those guys. And Vic Beasley finished tied for 31st with 33 pressures this year, with Devin Kennard having also 33 pressures and Emmanuel Ogbah being the only guy that rushed the quarterback, edge rusher at least, 400 times, at least 400 times and didn't finish with more pressures than Beasley, and he had 31. So basically, and typically, you know, if you rush the quarterback that many times, the assumption is, and when you look at the list of the guys that made that list, typically you're pretty good. And to be at the bottom of that list is not a good sign for Beasley. The point being, I agree with you, Aaron. For what Vic Beasley has been, certainly the last 2 years, and arguably was for large portions of the 2016 season as well, that is not worth keeping around. You can find a Bruce Irvin off the street, as we did, a Dwight Freeney off the street, and you can get that guy to give you the same amount of value. You can use your first-round pick, and presumably if you think you're going to get a better player with Tack McKinley than you got with Tack McKinley at pick 14, which you should hope and think, picking up 14 as opposed to, 26, you can get that guy comparable production from your first-round pick as you would get from Vic Beasley, or more production based off of the last couple of years. So we'll have to see. What's interesting is the argument that people will make for bringing back Vic Beasley is he got better over the second half of the season. And yeah, when you look at the sack totals, four out of his five sacks this year came in the last seven games of the year. But you want to know how many pressures he got in that span? 10. You want to know how many other edge rushers had at least 10 pressures over the last seven games of the regular season? 81. 81, guys. That's almost three per team. Right? And he's at the bottom of that list. Right? That means he's like basically, even at his best, when he was at his most productive during the season, presumably, he was like the equivalent of a third edge rusher for teams. So, you know, looking, and then for the sake of comparison, you want to know how many pressures Tack McKinley had over the last 7 weeks? 25. Bruce Irvin had 14. Brooks Reed had 6. Stephen Means had 5. Right, so I mean, basically, if we assume that you give Reed and or Means those snaps, that they would have been a lot more productive than 6 and 5. So why, I don't know. It's not to badmouth Vic Beasley. I'm not a Vic Beasley hater. I just have never really thought of him as being a great pass rusher. And I think the mistake that the Falcons have been making the last couple of seasons, and it's a forgivable mistake given their need to find pass rushers and the potential and the talent of Vic Beasley, you know, why not see what you can get out of him? But unfortunately, it hasn't produced results. And, you know, in hindsight, maybe those 2 years, instead of quote unquote wasting that time trying to make him into this pass rusher that he is not, maybe you could have made him into this hybrid linebacker pass rusher and given him another skill other than just relying on his inability to rush the quarterback and pressure the quarterback. So it is what it is, you know. So for me, basically, long story short, I think trying to salvage whatever you think you can get out of Vic Beasley, whether it's at $13 million or significantly reduced out, I think it's just better for you to cut bait and move on and hope he, you know. I hope the best for Vic Beasley. I think he's a good football player. I don't think he's a great pass rusher, but I think he's a good football player. And I hope he lands in a place where he can go on and that team can turn him into a better football player than what he is right now, because I think he has that ability in him. I mean, he's as athletic as you can get in this league, and like, there's still a part of me that's like, man, what if we had that same amount of athleticism playing linebacker, you know, because he's like 10 times the athlete that Devondre Campbell is, and Devondre Campbell's a really good athlete, you know, he's like he's arguably more athletic than Deion Jones, and man, imagine if we had sort of honed that and developed that. So there's a part of me that still wants to see that happen, but not for $13 million. And there's no reason to think that he's going to take significantly. We'll see what happens, but I don't see any reason why he's going to take significantly less. The Falcons, he has to do nothing, and the Falcons have to pay him $13 million by March 13th. And, you know, if he balks at that and they cut him, then I'm sure he's going to get more. I mean, he may not get $13 million, but he'll probably get a decent amount of guaranteed money on the open market, probably like $8, $9, $10 million at the very least, from somebody. So why? Why would he try to re-sign for considerably cheaper? You know, I played Grady Jarrett's agent earlier this year and basically said, take the Falcons for all the money you can get. And if I'm playing Vic Beasley's agent, I'm like, no, cut me. Set me free. You know, let's see what my market value is. Let's see if I can get, you know, fleece some other team out of a lucrative second contract or whatever. You know, not even use the word fleece. So I don't know. Now I'm rambling at this point, so I didn't want to go into a Vic Beasley rant, and I kind of did. So you already got like half of it, so I guess that means less I have to say on a future roster review when we talk about our edge rushers. So there you have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed that mailbag. I apologize for, you know, being short on some of these answers, but you know, some of them are just kind of like, I don't know. It's January. We'll find out in March, type of stuff. So. And some of it's September type of stuff. So we'll just have to be patient. And in the meantime, if you have additional questions that you want to send in, you can do so on Twitter, on Facebook. Locked On Falcons is the name of both pages, both accounts. LockedOnFalcons@mail.com is the email address. And, of course, you can leave a comment at FalcFans.com where the podcast is posted daily. And this week we will kick off our roster review. I don't know what day yet. We'll see. We'll get that thing going. All right. Until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.